And that's her, her intent is to kill commercial ag. But see, the HSU is infiltrated.
Sleeping in your bed.
I'd like to call the meeting of the Public Safety Committee to order. Here joining us today are Councilwoman Kirkpatrick, Councilman Sheldon, Councilman Taggart, Councilman Parrish, Councilman Holland, Councilman Smiley, Councilwoman Diller, Councilman Weiner, Councilman Retta, and my aide, Ms. Sharnice Jackson. What's your pleasure on the minutes?
Motion approved.
Second.
All's in favor?
Aye.
Minutes are approved as written. First item on the agenda is ordinance number 14-101. Amendment grants budget appropriate state funding for $254,486.76 to the fiscal year 2015 fund to combat violent crime grant for the Department of Public Safety. It's under my co-sponsorship with co-chairman Bell. I see the chief here, chief or director. Do either of you want to say anything about this?
Question, please.
Yes, sir.
Did you say 14?
101.
101?
I meant to.
Because okay. I have a different one. Sure. I was just wondering if I'm right or wrong here.
101 and 102.
Mine says 101.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Chief?
Yes, sir. Colonel Setting, Newcastle County Police. It's the funding that we use, that we apply for through grants. We use to put pay jobs into our CAPS areas, and it also supplants our overtime.
Any questions, concerns, members of council? Moving right along. Ordinance number 14-102. Amend the grants budget appropriate federal funding of $216,491 to the 2014 JAG Justice Assistance Grant, Data Driven Enforcement Strategies Grant for the Newcastle County Department of Public Safety. And the preceding item and this one will not be voted on until October 28th, but because this is a final public safety committee meeting before it is voted on, it's brought forward today. Chief, director, any comments?
On which one, sir?
14-102, the JAG grant, data-driven enforcement strategies.
No, sir. That is the grant for some equipment that we have requested that is confidential in nature.
Any concerns, questions from council? Moving right along, ordinance number 14-105. Again, this won't be voted on until October 28, 2014, at the final meeting for this month. It's to amend the capital budget, increase appropriations by $300,000 to recognize state funding of $50,000 and other funding City of Wilmington of $250,000 for the police range project. And Chief, you want to say anything about the proposed pistol range shooting range or whatever?
There's a possibility that we may have to leave our range at present. We are, the Director of Public Safety is working on the possibility of us also staying. Obviously, leaving the range and building our own range, very expensive venture. But we are trying to figure out if there's a way for us to stay where we're at and make corrections to the range that we presently have access to. But the importance of the range is not just for the Newcastle County Police, for the Wilmington Police and for about 20 other municipalities, is where we meet our Council on Police training. We have to have a certain amount of training with our firearms every year, and in order to meet that requirement, there has to be a range. And at present, there's a possibility that the Federal Army Corps of Engineers could ask us to leave the range that we're at.
Okay. Do you know the $300,000, $50,000 is coming from the state, and the other $250,000 is coming from the city of Wilmington?
That's correct, sir.
Okay. So there's obviously a partnership, and there is an opportunity for other police departments to participate going forward?
Well, we're all in the same boat. I mean, the answer to that in short is yes, because without that range, none of the other agencies can qualify either. The only agency in the state that would be able to qualify would be the Delaware State Police. Their range is used annually by them, so without us having a place to shoot, unfortunately, we're all in the same boat. The state is putting money into it because Ellesmere, Newcastle City, Newport, they would all have no place to shoot either.
Okay. Councilman Cartier.
Just for informational purposes, is this located along the Delaware at Oma Laden Range off Route 9? Is that where the range is located?
This is actually on the base next to Oma Laden, and this is literally on the National Guard base.
Okay.
But because it's on national or federal property, it's governed by the Federal Army Corps of Engineers. And they've made some very clear specifications that we are following, but it's not the long-term answer. The range is archaic in nature. It's not a bullet-catching system. It's just a pile of dirt. A bit archaic.
And it, Mr. Chairman, it probably presents some kind of pollution hazard now, perhaps. You know, so...
I can imagine that that's probably true, sir.
Yeah. Okay. So the Army Corps could ask us to leave, vacate that.
They are asking us to come up with a resolution by June 15, 2015. Now, we've met with General Vavila, and we have an extension on that if need be. The problem is, in order to build a new range, you have to have an open sky or no blue sky bullet catching system, and it's not cheap at all.
Thank you.
Councilman Powell.
So you have to build it with a roof over it?
No. It sounds like that, but no. It's just the baffling.
How do you have no blue sky?
It's just what the baffling system is called.
So. I mean, part of what are they wanting you to clean up the mess that's there?
Well, that's the decision that's being made at the federal level with the Army Corps of Engineers. It would be a concern if we had to clean it.
I mean, when you go over, a lot of people probably have done it.
Because it's probably leaching.
When you go over the bridge south of the Dover Air Force Base on Round 1 on the left, was a skeet shooting and shooting. And that whole marsh is full of lead. From shooting over it all.
Not our lead, though.
No, but your lead's probably, that's where you were shooting into a hill.
Pretty much what we've been doing.
You got lead in that hill.
Yep.
But now we can say, is it moving or not?
We have land that has been redesignated for a range just further down on 9 that's owned by the county. But we realize the cost associated with that. We're hoping that to stay where we are and put in a bullet catch system. That, as I stated, the director is currently in negotiations in regards to that.
You just can't pile dirt.
No, they don't want you to do that anymore.
She can volunteer.
And we are hoping to get more money from the state, obviously, sir. A lot more money. And the city.
Thank you.
Is the postal range in that area too?
Yes.
I mean, do we do anything with them?
It is a tiny range, and it wouldn't accommodate.
Okay.
It wouldn't even accommodate our schedule. In order for us to meet COPT standards, we go down to the range 4 and 5 times a year. Each officer has to meet a certain qualification. In order to do that with 380 sworn officers, not to mention all the other agencies, it would be virtually impossible as it is now. There's very few open days at the range where almost every lane isn't eaten up by one agency or another qualifying to include the University of Delaware.
Okay.
So, unfortunately.
The postal employees use the inside of the facility.
Councilman Redden and Councilman Powell.
And the postal facility, when you use it, they charge per capita. Each person there, they have a surcharge associated with it.
Okay.
And we may be going down that road as well with our range.
Governor Redd?
Thank you. Chief, would, if and when this happens, that we get a range, would there be any civilians allowed in there to use it, like, for qualifications that we would teach or anything in that
well,
nature?
Well, I mean, there's always been, it's sort of like mounted. If you have, if you're with a police officer and you have a reason for being there, we would have you sign a waiver. But if you were running a Citizens Police Academy, yeah, civilians would be allowed on the range with police.
I mean, if they wanted to carry. I mean, would that be like where they would get charged? Because I know they do it in Pennsylvania.
No, the police wouldn't be in the business of charging folks for that. Because in that, the first time they got out into a shooting, they would say, "Yeah, I'm qualified by the Newcastle County Police." And then now you're talking about deep pocket lawsuits. Well,
that's what I was wondering, because see, up in Pennsylvania they have a qualification area, and somehow or another, there's law enforcement in the back, but I don't think they teach. So that's what I was wondering.
No, sir. We would not certify anybody with a personal carrying permit at all.
Okay.
That's would lead to lawsuits.
Councilman Carr.
What is the, if you were going to build it, what's the cost?
Well, it depends on, you know, the amount of bells and whistles. We trimmed out the bells and whistles. The first proposal was, let's just say it was overwhelming. We've got it down to around $10 million. If we can stay where we're at, it'll be a lot less than that. So
I'd get a pile of dirt and let them find it.
You got communities with dirt.
That's true. That Bill does. I got them without dirt. They sold all the topsoil.
Any other questions, concerns from council members?
They didn't want to have to put a pile.
All right. I'm going to move to the presentation on the Ebola virus disease. And we're having a presentation from...
Sir? Director Bryant, Director of Public Safety. We'll have basically two presenters. It's about a 10 to 15 minute presentation. As you all know, we have a problem with this virus. It took less than 2 days for it to come from Africa to the United States. And it could very well get here, up here in Delaware, just as quickly. So we always talk about being prepared, having full knowledge of the situation and being prepared for it. So we would like to share with you this afternoon some background on this virus and where we stand as public safety when it comes to addressing this deadly disease. So we'll start off with Chief Tan, followed by Chief Miller. And we may have some comments from Dave Carpenter from the Office of Emergency Management, as well as the Colonel of the Police Department. Thank you.
Larry Tan, Chief of Emergency Medical Services. I'm going to just start off with just a description of the Ebola viral disease, since it has a medical twist. I get to be first up. And then we'll talk about some of the preparedness that the department's done, both from an EMS perspective, communications, and then wrap up with the Office of Emergency Management. Ebola is classified as a viral hemorrhagic fever, and that's its classification. And as its name would suggest, it's a viral infection, typically is accompanied by high fever, and results in generalized blood vessel damage. If you take a look at the picture, that arm is just a picture where the where there's been profuse bruising because of the rupture of the vasculature. The method of transmission, according to the Centers for Disease Control, is contact with blood or body fluids from someone who's infected. And when we start talking about prevention, then obviously isolation of those blood and body fluids is going to be tantamount to preventing human transmission. The reason that there's been a lot of media coverage is this is the most deadly Ebola outbreak in history. There have been other outbreaks of Ebola, just not to the level that we're seeing right now. The reality is that we're seeing a fatality rate of approximately 50%, and there's huge amounts of population in Western Africa that may potentially be affected. In the countries right now that that are seeing the outbreak, there are estimates that range anywhere from a low of 4 million people all the way up to 175 million that are potentially affected by this disease. And when you think about global travel and in today's world, the potential that that people can travel outside of the country into other areas is also causing concern. This is probably just about a month old data that talks about how many cases are being seen in each of these countries. And again, as we said before, the death rate is approximately 50%. A number of these cases involve healthcare workers, which is also concerning, particularly for those of us involved in healthcare. The other piece of this is that the signs and symptoms progress over a period of time. You've probably heard that there's roughly a 21-day period where somebody could potentially be at risk if they've been exposed to this particular disease. If you look on the left side of the slide, there's just a general outline of the sequence. It really doesn't start to show the first symptoms until after a week. So 7 to 9 days is when people will start seeing the first symptoms of a headache, fatigue, muscle soreness. When you get up to day 10, there'll be a sudden spike in the fever. You'll see vomiting, possibly some vomiting of blood. When you start getting into day 11 is when you start seeing the bruising, the rupture of the blood vessels, which causes the body-wide bruising. And when you get into day 12 is when you get into the later stages, the more critical stages. So if you look on the right side of the slide, these are the signs and symptoms that EMS personnel across the United States have been asked, as well as emergency department personnel, have been asked to monitor. And if you see somebody with those particular types of symptoms and they have a history of travel to Western Africa or they've been in contact with someone who's traveled in the past 21 days to Africa, those are cases that we're flagging to local public health as well as the CDC. So the message is that the entire country, all of the EMS and all of the healthcare workers have been asked to be on the lookout for these sets of symptoms and a history of travel or contact with somebody that's traveled, because they want to identify cases early on if at all possible. So what are some of the things that are being done from a preparedness standpoint? Well, number one, we are continuing to monitor the briefings out of the CDC and the Federal Department of Health and Human Services. It's a dynamic situation. We've been certainly watching the circumstances down in Dallas to see how that develops. We are also in contact with the Delaware Division of Public Health with the notices that they're putting out, as well as their coordination within Delaware. We've been coordinating with the receiving hospitals, and as late as Friday, the Division of Public Health is saying every hospital in Delaware is indicating that they are both ready and willing to accept patients that may potentially have an Ebola infection. So all of the hospitals are saying they're prepared, that they are capable and willing to receive patients. We all also have professional contacts, whether it's in emergency management, emergency communications, or EMS. We're all looking at what are some best practices with preparedness as well, and looking at our own organizations, that are the things that we can do a little bit better or in preparedness. So as I said earlier, primary means of transmission amongst humans, contact with blood or body fluids. And you know, if there is a silver lining on this, the method of transmission is very similar to some other diseases that we've had to deal with. HIV in the mid 80s, again, blood to blood transfer. And so the steps that we took back in the 80s to prevent HIV transmission and prevent exposure of our workforce to HIV are also worth, are also going to provide the same kind of protection that we're dealing with Ebola as well. So we're reinforcing to everyone strict use of personal protective equipment. Extra caution when you're doing certain procedures, particularly you're dealing with sharps, when you're starting IVs, or doing other clinical procedures that involve sharp instruments or objects. And minimizing exposure, minimizing the number of people that are in a confined space, for example, the back of an ambulance. So these are some things that we are already doing, things that are incorporated in the daily practice. We're just kind of reiterating that this is the right thing to do to, again, minimize the potential threat of exposure. We're also looking at the personal protective equipment that all of our personnel carry. We actually went out and got some additional kits where each kit is a self-contained disposable unit, contains hair cover, gloves, a gown, a mask, a surgical mask, as well as a biohazard disposal kit that can be opened. You can dispose of everything when you get to the hospital. You can get a new one, and then you're off. So it's just reiterating existing PPE, and we're verifying the availability of replacing those disposable supplies at the receiving hospitals as well. One of the other questions that we've been asked is, okay, it's flu season, and you know, yeah, we're concerned about Ebola, but we're also concerned about other things that people may have and carrying, and certainly when we were looking maybe 2 years ago at H1N1, there was a whole series of things that were implemented countywide. So here are the standard things that the CDC will recommend to prevent exposure to communicable diseases or infectious diseases, even as simple as the flu. Cover your cough. We no longer cough into your hand. Certainly when you extend your hand, the last thing you want is to be picking up somebody else's cough. We tell people if you're sick, or particularly if you're running a fever, avoid going to public gatherings. If it's in the workplace, you probably don't want people coming to work when they've got, you know, when they're dripping and they've been running a fever and they've been hacking all over the place. Do you really want to bring somebody into that workplace? Probably the single most important thing that people can do to prevent the spread of infection and disease is wash your hands. And it's not just getting your hands underwater, it's the physical motion of rubbing your hands all over under running water using soap that's important. Some people feel that, hey, I washed it, I put my hands under the water and walked away. That's actually ineffective. They've done tests where they'll actually put simulants, and at the end you put your hand under a black light, and if you haven't gone through the physical motion of forcefully rubbing your hands and using soap, you still got that stuff all over your hands. So hand washing is the single most important thing that people can do. Whether it's before you eat, whether it's after you use the restroom, whether it's, you know, whatever you're doing, washing your hands frequently can help prevent infection. And avoiding touching your eyes, nose, or mouth. One of the things that they're looking at in the Dallas case with the healthcare, with the nurse who is now being monitored, bless you, for Ebola, is did she potentially get involved in a procedure, touch your eyes, touch your nose, or touch your mouth, which are all mucous membranes and places where you can absorb that type of infection. So avoiding touching those areas, if your hands are dirty and they haven't been cleaned, is something else you can do to help avoid infection. So moving on to communications, and then certainly at the end, if there are questions, I'd be happy to take them. Chief.
Thank you, Chief Tim. Jeff Miller, Newcastle County 911 Center. We too were working in coordination with EMS, CDC, and the State Department of Health. So August 28th, the International Academy of Emergency Dispatch made their user agencies aware that they were developing a tool that 911 centers, who are a customer of their product, which we are, we use emergency medical dispatch protocols when processing every 911 call, that they were going to make available for our software system. On September 3rd, the CDC released interim guidance towards EMS and 911 public safety entering points, or 911 centers, and how they can deal with the Ebola virus disease in the United States down to the communications level, because 98% of Chief Tan's responses developed from a 911 phone call. So the communications center began in the first week of September testing the software, the updates, along with the priority dispatch in a beta testing system. We released that software within 3 weeks out to the floor to test it on a regular basis and how well it worked with our CAD system. And as recently as October the 1st, the state medical director allowed us to begin using this additional questioning system to help identify Ebola should people call with any of the major symptoms. Stomach virus, sudden onset of a high fever, sudden headache, any of those type of events, we'll move on to use what is called the Emerging Infectious Disease Surveillance Tool. And as you can see by the red arrow there, it's just a simple tool that we can click on. We've already developed, or we've already determined, where you see this piece here says a 6 Delta 4. We've already determined what the caller's need is, whether they need ALS and or BLS response to respond to their event that they're reporting. So we're not delaying the process that they will be notified or they'll get their help in. We're just adding to the end of the conversation a few simple questions. Once we get on that, we'll ask if they've had difficulty breathing or shortness of breath, if not already evident. If they've measured with a body temperature over 100 degrees, but we'll go all the way down to the bottom there. If they've traveled in the last 30 days, if so, where have you gone? And if any of the key locations, in this case, we answer Liberia. So based on that answer, the information is automatically, this is an example of what our CAD text looks like, the computer-aided dispatch system. So this is the information that EMS, ALS, BLS providers, and our first responders for police and OEM are capable of seeing using their mobile dispatch terminals. If you notice, we color coordinate things to the level of importance. So we've identified this person as difficulty breathing, their age, in yellow. We also state here that we've used the emerging infectious disease surveillance tool. Okay, that's nice to know, and that they answered all these questions in a certain way. However, down here in red, and this is what all the responders are used to looking to, emergency message, and that says that the person has traveled to Liberia, it's been confirmed, and it has occurred within the last 30 days. So the field responder is going to be getting that information right at the onset of the incident that they're being dispatched to. So they know it, the dispatch center knows it. We notify the EMS supervisors. We also notify the hospital that would most likely be receiving the patient. We also notify our state and our Newcastle County Medical Director that one of these events is currently taking place out in the field and we can prepare for the arrival at the hospital. So that way that everyone knows right from the beginning what to expect. So that's what we've done from the side of the communications division to prepare better for the, you know, the unlikely occurrence of this outbreak within the Newcastle County. And if there's any questions, if not,
Councilman McCarty.
Yes. Now, if we're going to respond, either our paramedics or the EMS folks are going to respond to someone who actually, has symptoms for Ebola. Is the latex glove that you folks use really sufficient, a sufficient barrier for a virus? Aren't they? Are they really?
It is. If I could tell you that, yes, it is. If you ended up with somebody who had the symptoms that we described up there, and the communication center is saying we've confirmed that there's been travel to Western Africa in the last 30 days, there's a good chance they will double glove.
Yeah.
And that's part of the reason the communications is giving us a heads up. But again, keep in mind that these are precautions that our people go through every day to prevent transmission of HIV, prevent transmission of hepatitis B and hepatitis C. So we're doing existing procedures, which is a plus. But if we get a heads up that they've got a fever, they're giving these types of symptoms, and oh, by the way, we've confirmed that they've been exposed to somebody who's traveled in the last 30 days to Western Africa, or they've traveled, we're probably going to double glove and be extra cautious, and that's a part of what we're looking at.
Now, you spoke about the biohazard kits that are, the EMS people have those as well?
Yes, they do.
Okay.
Good. I see the director.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, all of our first responders are equipped with that kit from head to toe. We have enough for every first responder plus. We actually just purchased another 1,000 kits last week. I'm not sure if they're in yet. But we have sufficient supplies in each one of the cars, both the police vehicles, the paramedic vehicles. We have all those supplies. We checked with CDC and the Department of Public Health when we made a decision on what type of equipment supplies to purchase. And they told us what to get. And actually, we actually went through on the Department of Public Health with our purchase that we just made last week. So we think that we're in pretty good shape, both from our communications and to our responders. Our communication folks are going to tell us if there's an issue, and we have the equipment if we need to put it on to make sure we're safe.
Councilwoman Dillon.
Just out of curiosity, a few years ago there was a big push with flu shots with H1N1. Would this be the same with Ebola, just to give people that extra chance for survival because of the immune system?
Are you saying should they take a flu shot?
Should they? Because, you know, for those of us who are looking at particularly senior populations.
Ebola is, at this point, an incurable disease, although they have some experimental medications that are showing some promise. Certainly the physicians that were flown into Emory that received an experimental medication, it seems to have some positive effects. You know, the issue for flu is, if the CDC recommends that if you are at an at-risk population, in other words, if you're a healthcare worker that's going to be exposed to a bunch of sick people, if you have predisposed medical conditions that make you at risk for particularly respiratory infections, or you work around or are a senior that may have existing medical conditions, they recommend that you get a flu shot. I mean, I can tell you personally, as a healthcare provider, I get one every year because I'm going to be around people that are taking care of sick people all the time. So the last thing I want to do is catch something and bring it home to the family. You know, would it be a benefit for Ebola? Ebola is viral.
Right.
The other piece of it is that there's no cure for it if you do contract it. So
right.
I'm not sure if we can say that getting a flu shot is going to potentially help you in this circumstance.
Any other questions? Councilman?
Just out of curiosity, how do you folks, work with the school systems? Are the nursing staff there connected at all with you folks and, you know, the preparation kits? I'm just curious.
The school nurses has a school nurses association.
Okay.
And they're tied in with public health through public health.
Okay, for any okay, that makes sense.
On the medical side,
right.
It's going to be the division of public health.
Right,
when it sits
right.
With when there's an overall biological, medical emergency type situation, the Delaware Emergency Management Agency is still a state lead as far as the coordination effort goes, just like we're the lead at the county for the emergency management for that coordination aspect of all the private sector and everybody else. But public health becomes the lead as far as the medical aspects of it and the coordination of the medical and the response aspects for medical purposes. So, as Larry said earlier, as Chief Dan said earlier, we've been coordinating with public health over the past several weeks on all that information. We just had a conference call with them on Friday. We'll have another conference call tomorrow with the hospitals again on furthering processes and protocols and clearing up all those items. They have already pushed out that information to the school districts also, given the fact that, again, coming upon flu season, you're seeing that rise of flu, not saying epidemic, but the rise of flu contraction within the school districts too.
Councilman Wan.
Thank you. The plasma of those survivors who have immunity systems that prevent infection and death is being used as one of the survival techniques. Do you happen to know anything about that? And also the drug companies in Canada, Britain, the United States are working on some trial meds for 1,200 victims, but that won't be ready until early 2015. And also, second part of that is how many folks have immune systems that survive, what percentage?
I would certainly not be able to answer that question. I don't have the World Health Organization data on that type of stuff for previous Ebola outbreaks. I've seen the same open source news that you've seen, where people that have survived, they're looking at whether the antibodies could be used to manufacture some type of vaccine. And my understanding is the federal government does have what they call an emergency use authorization, where they can go through a process and fast track medications. And whether that's been implemented at the federal level or not, I haven't been getting information on. But I'm sure at this point, given the nature and the scope of the outbreak in Western Africa, international resources are being brought to bear on looking at how can they control it, how can they contain it, and then ultimately how can you treat it. I wouldn't be surprised if you just have different pharmaceutical companies looking at what our things can do, but I don't have any information on that specifics.
Councilman Powell.
Just kind of with the question, just with other viruses. It's about, if you got 50% dying, it's 50% building antibodies for it. I mean, I had West Nile, and, you know, there's a lot of, if your immune system's down, you're going to probably die within the first 2 weeks, you know. A lot of the symptoms, except for the bleeding, is the same. Talk about a headache. I've never had a headache since after I got it, because there's nothing as bad as having it when I had it then. But I got more information from the state vet over West Nile than I did out of CDC. And afterwards, they were tickled to death for me, because I was one of the few cases that didn't go to a hospital, probably should have. But you know, you feel down and you feel like a truck went over. This was a semi backed over me 4 or 5 times is how bad. I said to my wife one day, I got a headache so bad my hair hurts, and my hair looked just like yours. And she said, you got no hair. But I know I just had to build antibodies. Okay. So the people that are surviving, the real problem, and it's the same in West Nile, and it's in horses, is a lot of racehorses, they're not vaccinating because it's a live vaccine. You're giving them the, and it'll slow the horse down. So the horse will survive, but it won't race as fast because you're giving them that virus. And, you know, and everybody thought when I went through it, oh, you could take an antibiotic. I said, this is a virus. It's just got to run its course. So it's either going to kill you or you're going to live. It sounds bad, but that's, I mean, we have it in livestock all the time.
I feel lucky.
I hope that's not what happened to my horse last weekend.
My infectious disease doctor, and I was his third patient.
It was scary.
The first one died the day after he died. The second one died.
Any other questions, concerns from council members? Questions, concerns from the public on this matter?
Motion to adjourn.
Not yet. I do have one thing on the other, and the stigma. You know, I think we've all seen the news, and we've all seen what has happened in Ferguson and what has happened in St. Louis. And I want this council to know that this public safety department, this police department, has been right on top of that. I have had conversations with the director, and the minute that happened, they started looking at training, they started looking at what we could do to prevent comparable occurrences, and if something did happen, what we would do differently above and beyond if we ran into that situation. So I want this council, and I really want the public to know that, again, public safety department, police department is right on point, being proactive as opposed to reactive. And I'm not asking them to come forward and say anything, but I do want everybody to know that they are working on that proactively. And me, as one of the co-chairs, have had that discussion with the director. So with that, Councilman Smiley.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Please adjourn.
Is it another show?
Yeah.
No, I don't bet y'all.
Hey, George.
If it ain't over 10, when I ain't
going, you should. The state vet says, nurses. 14 confirmed cases.